I think you need to have like a certain level of delusion to start doing drag.
Hello, my name's Kay Anderson and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. Now, who doesn't love a little bit of competition? I myself am rarely happier than when there are dreams to crush, plans to thwart, and hearts to break. Oh, I sound a little more unhinged than I regularly do. There's definitely something about competing that brings out, maybe let's not say the best of me, but a different side of me that's ready. But enough about me. I might have made this episode weird already. Instead, let's talk about this week's guest, Australian drag queen and co-host of the Death to Everyone podcast, Lazy Susan, who found herself getting a bit competitive when taking part in a drag competition in the Melbourne drag bar, The Greyhound. And it was through this that she fell in love with the space and the cast of characters who worked and socialized there. Let's start the conversation with Lazy telling us about how she first got into drag after leaving film school.
Well, drag is like, I don't know, it's something other than film. I had a lot of friends from film school just continued in film, at which point I think you're only making films about being in film. And I kind of went away, worked in hospo, got into drag.
And for our international listeners, hospo is hospitality.
I work in hospital in the wards. But yeah, no, worked in hospo. Like bummed around, and because you know I went to film school straight out of high school, and I think when you do that you can learn all the technical elements of filmmaking as much as you want, but if you don't have anything to say then it kind of doesn't matter, right? So I think now I'm more ready to come back to it because I'm like, oh, I have a better idea of who I am and what I want to do and what I want to talk about, and yeah, make a film that is going to be about drag, which is fun.
Shall we talk about drag?
Let's go on. Go on. Let's be silly.
No, it's a deeply, deeply serious art form.
Of course.
When did you have the first inkling that you might want to do drag?
I think in retrospect, the seeds had been planted along the way, but I never quite put the whole picture together until I had just thrown myself in one night at a bar. So Karen from Finance, Melbourne drag queen of RuPaul's Drag Race Down Under fame, she used to host screenings of Drag Race. And I got pulled along to a season 7 screening at a pub, which was fabulous. And she would offer a prize to the best dressed, trying to encourage, like, I don't know, a Thursday night drag moment. And so then I was like, well, I want a pint of beer, you know, as a prize. Please let me participate. So I cobbled together some of the most disgusting drag looks you've ever seen and went and really made a go of it to try and win that beer. I'll do anything for beer.
Wait, okay, so hang on. How much did you invest in the drag outfit that resulted in a potential pint of beer?
Well, this is why drag queens all need to have no sense of accounting, because if we ever looked at how much we were spending to what we were getting, none of us would ever do it again. The art form would not exist. But I would be spending many, many times over the cost of the pint. I could have just, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess, you know, there's the thrill of winning, right?
Well, that's what we're all in it for, right? To be seen winning and by looking like a goofy little pedal. But I only won like twice.
It's not nothing.
Well, you know, I did have to just make sure that the listener knew. It was twice, by the way.
Would you do it? But you mentioned earlier that the seeds had been planted much earlier. I don't think you said seeds. I just have to, there was inklings.
Say seed again.
The seed was planted.
The seed. I for my VCA, which is, what do you call that? Your in the UK.
GCSE.
Your A levels. I don't know. Whatever. I don't know. Whatever you do at the end of high school. But for drama, I did a monologue from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and I did it as Martha, Elizabeth Taylor. And it was like a full drag thing. And I think in my mind, I was just like, you know, this isn't drag. This is just like
actor.
A commitment to the... Exactly. And like, you know, just dressing up a lot. Like, we'd dress up a lot when we'd get drunk and hang out at a friend's house and put on all her clothes.
Hang on. So you thought that putting on your friend's clothes every time you got drunk was just a thing that people did?
Well, it was a thing that people, like, because I went to a community school and we were all theatre fags. So it was like the norm. Like, we all did it.
Okay,
we would sit around and play theatre games when we were drunk. We wouldn't, you know, like, that would be my childhood experience. And also, when I was like 15, oh, this is like very like the Wayback Machine, but when I was 15, my dad gave me a copy of this film called Torch Song Trilogy, which is based off a play by Harvey Fierstein, if you're familiar.
Who's not Harvey Weinstein, for people who are listening, just so we're clear.
No, he's pretty much the opposite in every respect of Harvey Weinstein. If you don't know him, he's the brother in Mrs. Doubtfire, and he speaks like this, and he's got the... Oh, he's like Edna Turnblad in the stage production of Hairspray. Mm-hmm. Anyway, my dad gave me a copy of this film, Torch Song Trilogy, which is Harvey Fierstein's like opus about his life growing up as a female impersonator in New York City prior to the AIDS crisis. And like his relationship with his mother, his relationship with his lover, everything, blah, blah, blah.
Can I just cut you off there just to say, I know Sarah's listening to this, and I need Sarah to know that Estelle Getty was in the original theatre production of Torch Song Trilogy in New York City.
Yes, yes. And in the film, it's Anne Bancroft, who is incredible, Mrs. Robinson from The Graduate. But the film was so important. And I remember there was a fire where I lived because I grew up in the forest. And there was a fire that would go on to be quite a deadly blaze. And we all had to evacuate. And I was watching the film and I was so transfixed that my dad was like, we need to leave now. And there was like smoke, you know, through the air. And I was just like, I couldn't believe that this film existed. And I didn't want to like leave before the film was done. So I was just like hovering in the lounge room with all of our personal belongings, family photos and everything around me, just like I couldn't believe that this film existed and that it was so exact. Everything that happened in that film, I felt like had some sort of relationship to things that had happened in my life. So I think that like the drag of it all, because it's about a drag queen, like then came on later, and I didn't realize at the time that that too would be like a kind of parallel with my life. So I think... Go and watch Torch Song Trilogy because it's a perfect film and I force everyone to watch and I sob uncontrollably and just like, it's great, perfect film.
So let me just ask a quick question. You're 15 years old and your dad gives you a copy of this film. Mm. What was he trying to say anything to you by giving you this film?
Well, I've been out since I was 13. So he knew, you know, my dad is an actor. And so he always says whenever he comes to see any drag stuff that I've been doing drag longer than you have, sweetheart. Before you were even born, I was doing drag on national television. He says that a lot. So he's always been completely supportive of drag and homosexuality because he came up around the theater and toured with West Side Story and everyone that he knew was big old flaming homosexuals. So I think that he, just like knew that it was genius as a film and wanted me to see it. And
so he wasn't nudging you towards drag?
No, and I think my dad's always been very, like, particular about drag because he thinks that it can be a bit of a crutch. Like, he thinks that it can be trash. And not in a way that's infused with the kind of classic, like, homophobia, but more just that he thinks, like, and I agree with this, sometimes you can forsake quality for the shock value of drag, or you can forsake quality for the immediate recognition and support of drag. And I think some people just get into drag, and not because they're particularly talented performers, but because, you know, they can don a lash and stand on stage and yell at people in a microphone, but it's not the same thing as being a talented performer. And I think as an actor, he saw that and was like, I wouldn't want you to, like, go and do that and then not think about why you're doing it and what the value is of it and, you know.
And what your point of view is and what you're trying to say.
Well, exactly, exactly. And, like, I think he always said, like, the most important thing is just that you're entertaining the audience. Like, don't let anything else get in the way of that, because coming up in theatre and stuff, you see a lot of people who get up and use the audience's time to act as therapy. And I think drag can definitely be a bit self-indulgent in that way sometimes, where it's like, and then I was never loved by my parents, and then Sparky fell down a well. And it's like, well, if you want to use your trauma as part of your life as an artist, you should, but you need to remember to be entertaining. Don't waste people's time, is what he always says.
Add a punchline to your trauma, for God's sake.
Absolutely. And that's why Harvey Fierstein is the best, because obviously he can get all of his trauma in there and still you have some of the biggest laughs watching that film while your whole life is on fire.
Okay. All right. So that helps paint the picture of the seeds that were planted. Oh, I just keep talking about these bloody seeds. But
I know. Jesus. Get off Grindr.
But it was unlocked and it was unleashed through these Drag Race screenings.
Yes.
When did the penny drop that you were like, oh, this is a thing and this is a thing I want to do?
I think, like all noxious creeping diseases, it takes a slow and slow boil before you realize you're fully infested. But I did like a competition after that, which was, I think when they started touring, you know, all the drag queens of Drag Race, they also started touring Michelle Visage around. And so she did a tour to Australia. And they were like, well, what's Michelle going to do? And this is before she was set on, like, singing at all her shows. But they were like, well, just get her to judge a drag competition every night in every town that she goes to. And people will love that because it's what she does on the show, blah, blah, blah. So she came and did Clash of the Queens. And then I entered that. That was kind of like a really, like, fabulous first little foray into performing on stage. Because it was like, oh. And at the Greyhound, actually. That was the first time I ever went to the Greyhound.
Which is what we're here to talk about.
Exactly.
So paint the picture of that first performance, if it's not too traumatic.
No.
What was it? What were you performing?
So, okay. Well, first, I think I need to, like any city in any large metropolitan area across the world, there's inevitably two factions of queerness, which is there is the, like, the arts degree, rough and ready, disgusting kind of punk people, those bags. And then there's the polished, you know, hit the gym at 6 a.m, perfect, like, you know, a more of a curated experience of homosexuality.
And there's no overlap.
Oh, absolutely not. Everything's binary, okay. Darling, didn't you hear?
Okay, all right. Okay, fantastic.
And in Melbourne, there's South Side and North Side. So broadly, South Side is very, like, put together, like, polished, fabulous. And then the North Side is grungy. And this is, it's not so much the case anymore since the famous collapse of the South Side, which we'll get into. But this has been the kind of binary for years and never the twain have met. And they lie on opposite sides of a river, the Yarra River. So there's always this thing about, would you cross the Yarra for love? Would you go on the other side of the river to try and find someone?
And is it a bit like West Side Story? I haven't seen that film, but I'm imagining it's just like this.
Absolutely, deeply that. Yeah, and then, so Greyhound is a South Side venue and had a lot of very iconic, very polished, classic drag queens. And so all of this to say, my booty leg asshole dragging myself into that venue as a kind of Northside art degree having, like, not makeup talent having drag queen was it did stick out a little bit at that time. And I got up and did Alejandro by Lady Gaga. I don't know if you know this young upstart called Stephanie.
I don't know.
She's going to be huge.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I was going to do Bogan Alejandro as performed live.
I feel as though we need to maybe explain the term Bogan.
Bogan. I guess like chav, if you're in the UK.
It's not chav.
Chav?
It's completely different. It's its own thing.
Yeah, it's Kath and Kim, if you know what Kath and Kim is. Oh, they're Bogan.
But they're more like Bougainvillea, aren't they?
I think like Bogan is, because I don't think they really have it in America.
Well, the closest equivalent would be like redneck, right? Even though it's different.
Redneck is what I go to, but then I kind of think Bogan isn't in Australia confined to socioeconomic status, because you can be a very wealthy Bogan. It's more about a mindset, a way of life.
Yeah, and a level of taste.
Yeah, it's taste. And a defiant enjoyment of I don't know, garbage, fabulous garbage.
Yeah, so it's like an absence of shame.
And I think in Australia, because we have an absence of like a really strong class culture, mm-hmm. that means that everyone is Bogan kind of in a lot of ways.
Wait, what? Unpack that.
Because Australia is such a, like, we don't have the super ingrained, in-depth, like, yeah. class structure like you have in the UK. There is no, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds-year-old tradition of peasant and lord or whatever. Whatever you guys are doing over there. Why Bogan kind of is... Bogan is the absence of culture and the absence of those... class structures.
But, oh, wait, so is Bogan a way for Australia to introduce a class system?
I mean, no, it's kind of the opposite. It's the great unifier is the Bogan mentality. It's a rejection of those things, perhaps.
But
it's a rejection of intellectualism. It's a rejection of class structures.
But in order to have Bogans and non-Bogans...
Yeah. You would say that the other people are the people that... desperately trying to maintain a class structure, and the Bogans are instead, you know, inveighing against the awful structures that had kept them down before they got on the boat.
Okay, I'm really sorry to anyone listening that we've over-intellectualized this. Just think someone in a singlet, although you don't call it singlets everywhere, someone in a vest and a pair of flip-flops or thongs carrying a beer. Just think of that. So back to Bogan Alejandro.
Yes, so Bogan Alejandro and my friend Matt, who is the now the sound producer on mine and Zelda Moon's podcast, Death to Everyone.
Plug, plug.
Thank you, plug, plug, plug. And he plays violin very well and he's a very sweet straight boy. And I said, would you please come and play Alejandro live on your violin next to me? And I'll be dressed in like a very ornate, or at least what I thought was ornate, ball gown, and then I'll get up and pretend that I'm taking a call at, you know, at the train station from several of my boyfriends, using the text of Alejandro to get across this conversation that I'm having while I'm trying to break up with all my boyfriends and keep things chill. And that was my first performance there, and it went well.
Why did your voice go up there at the end of that sentence?
Well, I didn't win, but I did come second.
That's good. Out of how many performers? Two?
No. How very dare you? It would have been out of like 8 or 9. And these were established girls. These were like, you know, ooh, working drag queens. So it was a bit of a coup, actually. And that's where I met Aisha Buffet, who's an incredible other Melbourne drag queen. And she booked me for my first shows at the Greyhound there. And my first ever paid drag gigs on the back of that. So not too shabby at all.
And so how did that feel then after coming second and, you know, having that moment of pride? Were you like, oh, I'm going to see what goes on with drag? Or were you like, oh, I'm all in, this is it?
No, I think I was just going to see. I think I was still just like you know, the further you get into drag, you do have to convince yourself that you're just doing it for a little bit, because you're really fucking over your love life the more you do drag. Aww. Like, I was like, I don't need to add another reason to why it's hard to date.
Okay, well, you're going to need to unpack this and tell me a bit more. So why are you fucking over your love life?
Well, I mean, particularly back then, I mean, it's, as time has gone on, it's become less and less of a taboo, but people would actively not date a drag queen. People thought it was very weird. Like, there would be certain people that just would not at all interact with you if they were, like, romantically, if you were a drag queen. It was considered, like, too femme, mm-hmm. too weird. And so you also have to be clean-shaven at all times. And I think, like any kind of facial hair is helping when it comes to, like, hooking up, at least in Melbourne.
Why?
I don't know. It just, like, people like a little bit of, like, rough beardiness, I think.
Because it tickles when they rim you.
Exactly. I think there's all those things that you have to get rid of in order to do drag that just make dating harder and harder and harder. So I think at that point I was just like, oh, do I really want to, like, yeah, like, pick a struggle kind of thing? Do I really want to add another thing?
And so were you aware of this stigma before you got into drag?
Yeah, I think I was aware of it because at that point I was still some, like, an outsider to the entire experience. So I think I still had my hang-ups about what I thought drag was and what I thought was weird about it or whatever.
And so you were not very certain about pursuing drag?
Well, I was waiting for the, like, if someone was like, oh, we can do this gig, then I was like, okay, great. You know what I mean? So it's like, it kind of just built on itself. I think I had to keep finding new, like, points of engagement to just be like, okay, now I'll do this and now I'll do this. Like, project-based instead of just being like, I'm signing up to a life in drag.
So you were just waiting for things to happen rather than pursuing them.
Well, exactly. Manifesting, as people in LA would say.
But I don't know, but that isn't manifesting, is it?
Well, if you do, like, you know, say you do the drag competition, like the Michelle Visage Clash of the Queens, and then someone invites you to do another gig, you're like, oh, well, how could I say no to this, you know? And then you do that gig, and then while you're doing that gig, they're like, oh, well, there's also this thing. And then you say, oh, well, how could I say no to that? You know, like, so you have to kind of trick yourself into doing it piece by piece instead of just going in the whole hog.
All at the same time as you then also saying, oh, I'm only doing this for a little while.
Yeah, yeah, I think as well, like, I think if I'd known how much of my life it would become, I probably would have freaked out and run away. Have you ever done drag?
No.
Have you ever dated a drag queen?
I don't think so, but I've also not dated very many people.
Well, you're the lucky one. Yeah, it's all just disgusting. Like, I think you can't even accentuate to the listener how foul and disgusting drag is. My boyfriend, so I do, like, spoiler alert, now have a boyfriend, but my boyfriend was commiserating with another drag sister of mine's boyfriend recently about the first time that you ever have to put your boyfriend into a corset before a gig or take them out of a corset.
That would be kind of fun though, wouldn't it? Like, causing you pain.
Well, yeah, it's a pain for me, but it's more of a, like, a psychic horror for them, kind of a Cthulhu-esque monster.
Oh, how come?
Well, you just, like, you've never lived until you've seen your partner's, like, whole back Play-Doh fun factory out of the back of, like, a binded ribbon. It's not correct. And then when you take it off later, it's drenched, in my case, drenched in sweat. It's not nice. And then also your whole life, like, you know, if you're renting, there's a whole room seemingly of every drag queen's house that's just filled with drag. So it just takes over in such an alarming way. And as we discussed before, the cost of it is so immense. So you're spending all your money, you're broke all the time, everything's drenched in sweat, you're doing late nights, and at the end of it, you're just, like, performing in a bar, being a silly little binti. Drag is a disgusting, disgusting thing.
Well, but yeah, okay, and yet, despite all of this, I am talking to Lazy Susan, the drag performer.
Well, exactly, yeah. Well, she's a sadomasochist, what can I say?
But what drove you to continue?
But that's what I'm saying. If you were conscious of everything that was to come when you started, then you wouldn't do it. But it needs to be piece by piece, slowly entering your life, and then you can accept it, because it's the sunk cost fallacy. You're like, well, I've come this far, I may as well keep going.
Yeah, but like, despite all of that, you still said yes to all of those opportunities, even though you did some like jujitsu mind shit with yourself, pretending that you were going to get up anytime.
Yeah, no, I did. And well, that's it. Like, you know, if the police investigate, I did, of course, consent to all of this. And here we are. And I love it. I wouldn't change it for anything now. But it's a wild thing.
Yeah, so what made you say yes every time rather than, fuck no, I'm going to stay home and watch movies?
No, because you're saying yes to, oh, next Friday, come and do a show here and we'll pay you, you know, whatever. And you can have some beverages. Like, that doesn't sound like, and then everything you own will suddenly be women's clothing.
You won't be able to get the glitter out of your hair for the next 7 weeks.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. No, so if they'd said that, I would have run away. But because it was just little things, you'd be like, oh, that sounds good. That sounds easy. And, you know, I think I was looking for the thing. Like, I was looking for the new art form. Because I was so frustrated with filmmaking after going through film school. Like, the thing about film school is you spend a lot of money making a short film and you spend a lot of people's time making a film, and it can take as long as you want it to take. And it's this completely closed off process. And then finally you make this thing and then you show it to, I don't know, your class, or like you do a graduating screening, or maybe you even get it into a festival. And it's part of a shorts package that plays at a festival. And inevitably, you're playing it to a room full of maybe 200 people, and it's taken you like half a year to get that thing done. And there was something so exciting and fabulous about drag, because it was like you can play to 300 people with a performance that you've just come up with that week and take that impulse and that creativity and that thing that you want to make, and not wait on money and not wait on anyone else's okay or say so or involvement, and just go and perform and get your thoughts, your ideas, your message out there as quickly as possible. It felt so much more alive and cool and fun. And it was directed straight to the queer community, which were the people that I wanted to talk to with my art or whatever. Yeah. It just felt cool and alive and fabulous. So I think all of those things made it really tempting after doing an art form that's so slow and scattershot.
But you had lots of experience in spending money, so you carried that over.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Drag could be expensive, but goddamn, it'll never be as expensive as being a student filmmaker. Yeah.
So we're here to talk about The Greyhound. And I want to pick up on the things that you were talking about earlier in respect of the North and South divide. And you have talked about yourself as being a Northsider. Do you call them Northsiders? Did I just make that up?
Northside gals. Yeah. I need to stress, we're living in the post Mean Girls kind of moment, where it's like there's now peace in girl world. Because we'll get to it, but with the collapse of the Greyhound Hotel, the South Side kind of didn't have as many venues anymore to get the gals in. So the Southside girlies ended up coming Northside.
And you didn't want to just like keep up the beef? Like, that would be fun, right?
I mean, listen, I'm not saying it doesn't sometimes erupt, but it no longer exists along geographic lines.
So as someone who was a Northside gal, I think that's what you said. Were you very like territorial and like, I'm never going to be like the South, or were you just not really buying into it?
Well, no, I think that was the West Side Story or the Romeo and Juliet of it all. It's like you enter and you realize that there's these age-old divides that are keeping those things in place, and like, oh well, I don't get why we're doing that or whatever. So
So you're telling me you had no inkling, you had no idea?
Well, I didn't know how that, like, I didn't know about the lay of the land as far as how drag was set up at that time. So when I entered it, I didn't realize that there was that divide.
So this is a drag thing and not a wider queer scene thing.
It is definitely a wider queer scene thing, but I didn't realize that it was such an important part of the drag scene at that time.
Okay, okay. So you weren't going to the Greyhound with these preconceived ideas of like, oh, they're all Southsiders and they're going to be like, what is she doing here? You were just like, oh, yeah, I'll just go along.
I'll just go and be a silly little Binti. And then, yeah, then it kind of became a bit more apparent. When everyone's like, oh, that's so weird.
In a really condescending way. Oh, you're so different.
I love that about you.
It's great that you've come out here to try.
Brave, so brave.
But so, yeah, so to talk to me about going to the Greyhound for the first time, like, what was it like walking through the door?
Well, so the Greyhound Hotel used to be a bit of a dive bar, famously, like in a fabulous way. And that's a part of its history that I don't have any part of, which people, like, when I got to the Greyhound, were all like, oh, I miss the old sticky floor days, because they'd gone through this massive multi-million-dollar renovation to upgrade the venue. And they turned this old kind of Victorian bar on the corner of a highway into this like Miami style huge open stage with a 2-story LED screen and a mezzanine VIP viewing area and booths around the side and like mirrored surfaces everywhere you looked. They'd taken this kind of like, you know, shoddy drag dive bar and turned it into this like mecca of drag. Mm-hmm. And that was when I arrived. And I was so into that because it was just insane the scale to which they'd gone to for like just drag shows. Like there were not other shows happening on that stage. So it was overwhelming and very cool and felt like it was the best or the biggest stage in Melbourne to perform on. It was incredible. It was like absolutely obscene.
So then tell me about that first time then. So you're walking in, you know that you're going to be part of this talent show. Was that super exciting or super intimidating to be in this plush space?
Well, yeah, it was very exciting. I brought dear sweet Matt, the sound engineer, straight boy, along. And so he was contending with the thing that happens whenever you bring a straight man backstage at a drag venue, just that he was being absolutely harangued, harassed and thirsted over, which was fab. So I was kind of playing defense on the poor boy. And then I think I just had an absolute blind confidence that this was good and that it was going to be great. It was going to be awesome.
Ah.
I think you need to have like a certain level of delusion to start doing drag.
So where does your delusion come from?
My God, I don't know. I think a lot of drag queens start because they see other drag and they think, oh, I could do that and I could do it better or my style or whatever. And so I think that that's where the delusion comes from, is that you really think that you're like reinventing the wheel. And I don't think you should start doing drag unless you have that impulse that you're going to improve upon the form in some way, even if it's complete bullshit, which of course it is. But like,
well, yeah, yeah. But I think that happens in all art forms, right? Like you go and see a performer or you go and see an actor or you watch an episode of EastEnders and you're like, well, that's shit. I'm going to do much better than that. But then, you know, you get into it and you realize that actually it's hard. So how do you maintain the delusion after looking at your drag makeup in the mirror? And this is not directed at you.
No, but I would say it is distinct from other art forms in the sense that, except for maybe acting, but like I think when you go and see the ballet or when you see someone, you know, play the cello incredibly well, you could be in awe of the proficiency and the incredible artfulness of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And one of the blessings of drag is that it's kind of an outsider art form in the sense that it doesn't require a classical education.
Not yet.
Well, exactly. Wait for it to be subsumed. But it's like a folk art almost. It's a folk art in the sense that it's practice and it's the knowledge base of it is just passed through tradition and through, you know, like it's completely passed from generation to generation and not ever written down. And so I think it is one of those art forms that you can look at and from the outside, yeah, assume that you could do it better as opposed to aspiring to reach a level of technical proficiency with it. And it's an art form that requires delusion more than any other art form because that's what it sell or what it trades in.
But there's still the poison of comparison, right? Like you're still performing with lots of other performers. You're still seeing lots of other performers. So at some point you're going to be like, oh, am I as good as them?
Yeah. Well, I would imagine, I think that that's why girls stop doing it. Only the most deluded can stay in this business for as long as we need to do.
And I need to tap into this. Like, where do you get this delusion? Because I need to sprinkle some across my life.
Do you know, I think that's why it is a gay art form. I think, like, being gay...
Are you just saying all gays are deluded?
Well, I think the... And when I say gay, I guess I mean, like, the whole spectrum. I mean, like, the queer diaspora. But when you're queer, you're, like, you're trained to envisage your life as being better than it is because there are going to be times when it's really ugly. And when people treat you in a way that is bizarre and cruel. And so you almost need to invent a very robust imagination for life being good in order to survive as a queer person. And I think that's where drag comes from. It's about pretending that things are more fabulous than they are and pretending that life is really gay-centered and beautiful. And so drag and gayness requires delusion because the world is not what you want it to be.
Okay, but that doesn't give me any tips on how I can become more deluded.
Be more gay, suck more dick. What am I telling you here?
How many more dicks do I need to suck?
I don't know, darling. That's between you and your God.
I've got lockjaw as it is.
Maybe suck in a more deluded way.
Well, how do I suck it? Anyway,
the more deluded you are, and this is the thing, the magic of it, is that like the fantasy is when you go and see a drag show is that you're seeing Beyoncé on stage, right? And and that the audience needs to live in a certain amount of denial to pretend that that 6'5" man is Beyoncé. And so everyone needs to have this shared delusion about you and the quality of your performance in order for drag to work. It's like one of the few art forms that requires the audience to be just 100% on your side no matter what. Like if you go and see stand-up, the audience is automatically offside and doesn't want you to succeed and will sit there and wait for you to make them laugh in a kind of like a challenge to you, whereas drag is the exact opposite. Everyone is on your side from the second you step on stage because we're all sharing and maintaining this fairy dust illusion that is Beyoncé, that we're all watching something magnificent and beautiful and choreographed and, yeah, we're not going to notice the lace line.
Are you telling me that every single performance that you've ever had, you've had the audience bought into that delusion?
No, and the ones where it doesn't work is one where they don't come on the journey or that you, like, lose them. Mm. And that happens. That you have to then just step up your level of like, it's fine.
Okay, let's talk about the Greyhound because that's what we're here to talk about. So after this first night, after you've got that taste, you're like, I would have won if it wasn't for that bitch. Did you perform at the Greyhound again?
Yes, so then based on that night, Dear Sweet Asia Buffet, who was another kind of, she was an aberration in the South Side scene as well. She had spotted me and was like, oh, this chick's a bit of a weirdo, so I'm going to absolutely go and do something with her. And she was the reigning queen of Dragnet, which was the drag competition that they held at the Greyhound. So as the reigning queen of this Dragnet competition, she had been given a Friday night show in the front room theater, which was a smaller front room where you would take your hens parties and drink wet pussy shots. And there was a small stage. And so she got to do like a Friday night residency there and pick whoever she wanted to come with her. So she invited me along to come and do one of those shows at the Greyhound. And that was fab. And that was kind of like the start of that friendship, which is... incredibly important to my drag career and just life in general, is getting to know Asia Buffet. She's the sort of person that, like, every single person is kind of enthralled by her charisma. She's just, like, a next-level performer.
And how has knowing her helped you?
I think, like, to get anywhere in drag, you need to start developing your relationships within the drag scene. And Asia was always such a booster of me. Like, she always saw my value and saw my potential and really would, just find, like, little opportunities or anything. And she did that with a lot of people. She still does it now. She's always kind of collecting new faces and people that she thinks are incredible and talented and kind of puts them in a situation where they can get the opportunity to perform, because she's never threatened by other people. I don't think she thinks of other drag queens as her competition. She's just interested and excited by fun drag that she likes. So she's like, mm-hmm. get this bitch over here.
And to be all like cringe and cheesy, what did she see in you?
I just think like stupidity. Like, I think a lot of the vibe was,
but
like,
plenty of people are stupid.
But not so artfully stupid, I suppose. No, the commitment to the gag and the stupidity. In lieu of dance talent or the ability to move rhythmically, I've just chosen a commitment to stupidity at all times.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that on your business card?
Who can afford business cards? Jesus. But it'll be on the tombstone, yeah.
Okay.
But I think because I'd had that experience doing other types of art, I had a real commitment to, like, just making it as big and stupid as possible, including, like, mm-hmm. props, which remain far too much of my drag, is prop-reliant. And, yeah, doing elaborate bits.
And so the Greyhound closed down.
Tragically. Valet.
How much time had passed between this first performance and the Greyhound closing?
I'm glad you asked. So that first performance happened, then the first Friday night gig, and then along comes Dragnet for the next year, which was, mm-hmm. as we know, Asia Buffet was the reigning queen of Dragnet. And the way that these drag competitions work, or this one did at least, was that it was a weekly heat-by-heat competition that went over 2 months, 2.5 months maybe. And you weren't in every heat, but like you would be put, you know, with three other drag performers. And if you won your heat, then you would go through to the semifinals. Mm-hmm. And it would be a great way of getting people into the bar to come and see their friend and support their friend. And if you had four performers, then you'd have four people performing for free that would all bring their friends along to watch them perform on this big stage. Mm-hmm. And then the final prize was like $3,000 and the crown and the sash and like all of these other little prizes and like a show, like a residency at the Greyhound. Mm-hmm. And so all of that was happening. And then that Asia was like, you need to get in, enter this drag show and give it a shot.
But surely that's a conflict of interest for Asia.
Oh, darling, drag is just nothing but absolute
conflict.
Yeah.
And interests. Okay. All right. Okay. Sorry. Ignore what I said. Carry on.
So that competition comes up and I go out in my first heat.
Oh, so not too much of a conflict.
Yeah, truly, I was out. But that I met a bunch of, there were 16 girls in the competition, I believe, and it was like people took, we took it so seriously, and it was such a like, people had been entering for years and, you know, had been going for 3 years. So like by that point, people were like, I need to win this competition. And people would invest all this time and money in the outfits and the, you know, backup dancers and the whole thing. And they did like photo shoots and interviews. Like we were pretending like this was full on RuPaul's Drag Race. And the cast was incredible. It was like so much fun to meet all of these other amazing drag queens. And then went out on the first heat. That was very sad for me.
Sorry to laugh.
Yeah, how dare you. And then I went out and then I came back into the competition as the thing called the venue select. The venue was allowed to put one drag queen back in, and that for some reason went to me, which was very good. And then went through the semi-final. Oh God, there were so many heats. They all had different names, but this was like the Oh, it was called the wild card round. Went through the wild card round, made it through that round, and then went out on the next round, which was the semi-final. And then they were going to bring back one girl based on votes. You could vote. Vote online or
this
vote by
very complicated.
Well, you know, the more like low stakes the competition, the more intricate the rules are. And so there was a voting thing where they were like, if you can get enough votes from the public, then you can come back in. And by that point, I was so exhausted because I'd performed so many times more than anyone else because I kept getting back in. Then that's when I remember like leaving the Greyhound that night, just being so cut after just being like, I've done so much and like, what am I going to do? And I remember Aisha coming with me out to my car with my drag stuff. And she was like, honey, I don't know what you're thinking. Like, you need to, like, just calm down. And I'm like, I'm not going to, like, get people to vote for me. It's just like, what the fuck? And she was like, if you wake up tomorrow morning and you don't make an effort to try and get yourself a spot in that final, you will hate yourself forever. So just, you know, go to sleep, think on it. But I think you should just try. At that point, I was like, no, fuck. And then I went home. And then in the morning, I was like, okay, I think I could, like, actually make a go of this. And so then I sent the word out to my friends. I was like, I'm going to try and win this People's Choice re-entrance into the competition. And the way that people mobilized was so heartwarming. It was one of my dear straight friends from film school, he was like, this is, because he'd come to like some of the shows and he was like, oh, I love you, like you're great. And he was just like, this is an absolute miscarriage of justice. I'm going to go. And he like spread the word to all his friends and they were like, come on for lazy. And yeah, it just, there was enough people that kind of rallied behind me and then they got me over the line and I went into the final and then I won. And then I became the reigning queen.
I am so glad that you ended up winning because this story.
It's got the ups and downs. It's got the triumphs. It was, yeah. And what an experience. And then so I won and then the place closed.
And then so the place just closed down. What did it feel like hearing that the place was going to close? Like, or did you know before it closed or did it just close dramatically?
It was incredibly tragic. And I remember the night that we all kind of came to terms with the fact that it was going to be closing, everyone just arrived at the venue one by one. And there was like, you know, 18-year-olds who just moved in from the sticks and were getting, working their first jobs at the bar. And there were all these drag queens and everyone was just sitting around in this kind of eerily quiet, massive cavernous venue and just sobbing. Like it was so intense knowing that this place was just going to go. And everyone was just like bewildered because it was such a like institution. All this competition stuff and all the shows that they did, people took it so seriously. And that was that shared delusion. This was like a place that was built up and a place that fostered new talent and a place that brought all these people together. And there were some like legends who were the people that were running it. And and it was just bizarre to see these people that had so much to give and so much power over that venue and so much influence over the Melbourne drag scene in one fell swoop, just completely have that taken away. And because it is a folk art, those things just vanish. Like they don't come back.
And so, getting cheesy, because that's my want.
Yeah, please do.
If you could have a conversation with that 15-year-old lazy Susan who is refusing to believe that the bushfire is encroaching on her house and just is carrying on watching this Harvey Firestein film, what advice would you give to that little version of you?
Ooh, invest in Bitcoin, but then sell before 2022. I don't even know because, I don't know, that kid seemed to have it together. They were just on their journey. Like any of the fear or anything about drag, like, eventually the time will come where the world will not be, where you can, like, sustain a love life and do all of those things.
Oh, would some good advice be don't get your boyfriend to help you into a corset?
Unfortunately, it's there's nothing he can do. Like, that's just inevitable.
Oh, okay.
You need, okay. You know what I mean? Like you need someone there to get you into it. So if it wasn't my boyfriend, it'd be my poor housemate.
Yeah, make sure you have a housemate.
Make sure you, yeah, it's great advice for life in general. Yeah, do it with company. Yeah. cherish the experience of these places, because these places do disappear and then you become the old queen at the bar harping on about places that are closed long ago. You do need to treasure them when you have them. Because I think as well, gay people, we love to complain, and it is one of our other art forms.
Superpowers, yeah.
It's truly incredible. And I don't begrudge that. I think it's fabulous. But I wish that gay people would, or queer people would, spend less time complaining about their venues, because they're so precious. And like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe the owner is a crazy meth addict who occasionally screams obscenities into the night. But you're going to miss that when it's gone, darling. You just need to, you just need to remember that these things are fleeting.
Okay.
That's my advice.
Do you have any memories of the Greyhound, or maybe clubbing from your own queer scene that you want to share? Well, if you do, why not get in touch? I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I can't do it alone. I need your help. Go to lostspacespodcast.com, find the section Share a Lost Space, and then tell me all about what it is you got up to. You could also reach out to me on Facebook or Instagram, where my handle is Lost Spaces Pod. Find out more about Lazy Susan by listening to her podcast, Death to Everyone, which she co-hosts with Zelda Moon. Or you can also follow her on Instagram, where she is at Ms. Lazy Susan, MS Lazy Susan. If you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you took the time to subscribe, leave a review on your podcast platform, or just tell somebody else who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen. My name's Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.